You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 48 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And you No, that was too hot. I kinda wanna leave this in now.
Having some problems here.
Hello and welcome to episode number 48 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And we have a jam-packed episode. There is a lot going on.
We are going to cover a variety of different Seattle sports teams and things.
Restaurants.
And food.
You mean restaurants?
Yeah, all of that. But first, what do we have to drink here?
Oh, well, what we have here from our good friends at the Brewmaster's Tap Room in Renton, Washington, is from Everybody's Brewing in White Salmon, Washington, is the Everybody's Euro Smash SMASH IPA. And here's what Everybody's Brewing has to say about this. A German edition featuring Moderina Bavaria. Our Euro Smash IPA series will feature our two-row base malt and a hop variety from a different European country each time. First up, Germany!
I think you should have waited for them to have the Italian hops. If that's even... I don't know if that's actually a
Italian
thing.
That's called wine.
I know. That is what it's called.
It's when you pour Peroni into a different bottle.
Yes. A message while you're pouring here. We wanted to give out a shout... We wanted to give a shout out to our loyal listener, Anthony, who we understand underwent hernia surgery today. So hope you get well soon and hope that listening to this podcast will not exacerbate the pain as you recover from that right now.
And as it does for most people and both of us.
Exactly. Exactly.
It didn't feel right to do a toast.
No, that seemed a little wrong.
But can I
propose a toast?
Oh, we're proposing a toast. Well, I was going to say, we hope that you feel better, Anthony. And I just want to give a toast. This toast is for you and for whatever else you're going to toast to.
I wanted to toast to the end of, we'll maybe talk about this a little more later, but the end of one of the finest careers in Seattle sports history with Kelsey Plum and UW women's season coming to an end last Friday night in Oklahoma City. But finished her career, I think beat Jackie Styles' record by ultimately about, you know, a couple hundred points.
Oh, man.
Put it safely in the rearview mirror. So
a couple hundred points.
Really impressive career for Kelsey Plum, who also was named first team All-American, unanimously picked to that this week. So
I'm curious for you to try this beer.
Oh, what are you? Is it because it you tastes, think I'm not going to like it?
It tastes like drinking a German chocolate cake.
You think so?
It's really sweet.
It's terrific.
It's great beer, right? It's almost like...
I don't think I like German chocolate cake, but I like this.
It's really, really sweet beer. Yeah, I'm pretty in on this. I tasted a bunch of beers before I chose it. And the rest, I haven't drank a lot of IPAs lately, as you know.
Wait, do I know that?
Well, I've mostly been drinking sour beer.
Oh, yeah.
And so the flavor palette with an IPA was a little bit shocking to my senses when I was trying them.
In a good way?
No.
Oh, okay. We also wanted to pour some out, I think, today. For
to
a long
Anthony's hernia.
No. A long time friend that has come to an end. It's been reported. Cairo 7 ending its live coverage of the Seafair hydroplane races.
We're getting into this.
After decades.
We're getting into this.
Decades.
We're not just pouring one out right here for that coverage. We're pouring one out for a piece of Seattle history.
Well, it's not like Seafair itself is coming to an end.
This
here.
Is the first step.
I was thinking about this today, and I was like, I know at some point in my lifetime, the Seafair hydroplane races will cease to exist, and that will be, yeah, that's going to be a really sad Pelton cast when that happens. I mean, sadder than the Romar Fired podcast.
Okay,
even.
So the hydroplane races will still happen.
Yes.
They just won't be on TV. So people who want to go and party in the log boom will be fine.
Yes. Which is the core demographic of Seafair at this point, I think. That and old guys.
Oh, yeah, very old guys. And you somehow.
I am functionally an old guy in many ways. And this is in my interest in hydroplane racing is key among them.
I'm just like so excited for the podcast in early August when we do a full breakdown of Seafair.
Yeah. That's people don't know what's going to hit them then.
Yeah, no, people are not ready.
But here's the thing about the live TV coverage. It's... Number one, like, there's not like a lot of casual Hydroplane fans who are like, you know, I'd throw this around in the background. Like, if you're really interested enough in Hydroplane racing, you're going to the race.
But I don't know if I agree with you there.
So you think, because you think you're in that demographic?
I mean, I'm in the casual Hydroplane fan demographic. The thing is, going to the Hydroplane races is terrible, right? You have to go very early. You have to sit with other people on a lawn, right? But not a flat lawn. It's a hill that you're sitting on.
It's true.
You have to be able to balance your body on a hill. You're more or less like a mountain goat there.
Last year you got rained on, I think.
You could get rained on. You have to go insanely early. Did I mention that?
You don't have to. I mean, if you want to like claim a prime spot as we do, you have to go insanely early.
Everything, and just be crammed in with a bunch of other people.
That's true. Yeah. But
everything about the experience is completely terrible, and that's why it was good to have it on TV.
If it's nice weather, you're just sitting outside by a lake, which is not too bad.
But kind of bored for like 10 hours straight. That's the other thing. Watching at home, you go in, you watch the races. If it's a nice day, you can go play outside, do whatever you want. If it's a crappy day, you can sit inside and not get rained on. Really, it's the perfect, I hesitate to call it a sport, but it's the perfect sport to be viewed on TV.
Wow, you have sold me on this. I came in with completely the opposite opinion, and you should probably call up Cairo and complain.
Okay, you want another take?
Okay,
what are they airing instead?
That's the other thought I had.
There's being preempted for repeats of Judge Joe Brown. What is the programming that's happening on a normal Sunday in August on Cairo?
The reason they're not doing it is because it's presumably extremely expensive to air this broadcast, because you've got to set up, you know, the cameras throughout what's the name of the park again?
Sayers.
Stan Sayers Pits.
Stan Sayers Pits.
The pits are named after Stan Sayers. I forget what the name of the park is. Genesee Park.
Such a big Hydroplane fan.
Genesee Park.
Look, you've never actually been to a Hydroplane race.
Look, I can drive there like at any time. You could blindfold me and I could find my way there. Knowing the name of the park is a different thing entirely. You've got to set up the cameras. You've got to set up, like, you know, the ability to film Steve Rabel and the rest of the broadcast crew in the pits. I mean, it's probably a lot of money for like 6 hours of broadcasting.
Steve Rabel don't come cheap.
That's true. That's true. He doesn't get out of bed for less than $100,000.
Sure, I understand it from that perspective, but it's like, it's such a unique thing to air. They were trying to sell it as both Cairo and the head of Seafair were trying to sell it as this was a positive for Seafair.
Wait, what? Because of the fact that it was like less competition for them selling tickets?
Well, they're going to preempt 60 minutes or something, right? So the fact that it's so important that it could prevent or preempt 60 minutes was important.
So that, like, for the final race?
No, for a recap in the nighttime.
Oh.
So they're not airing the races individually. And granted, I do accept that Hydroplane racing being viewed in an hour and a half period with just the interesting parts is a great idea.
Oh, the half hour recaps they used to do on ESPN back in the day. I don't know if literally any of our listeners watched those, but they were like national at that point, but it would be like weeks after the race occurred.
So, I mean, that is a good way to view Hydroplane racing because it is incredibly boring. I mean, this is the reason that Hydroplane racing is not a popular sport, because it is the most incredibly boring sport to go to. It's interesting for literally 5 seconds until the race is over within the first half lap. Do you disagree with this?
No, but you're outside. It's just a pleasant...
The only thing that your only selling point is being outside.
It really is.
It'd be like... They could be like preempting airing, I don't know, a park, just like a live feed of a park on a Sunday in the summer.
But from a TV standpoint, that part of it doesn't come across. I'm talking about the attendance.
Sure. I have way too many. I have both negative and positive takes on Hydroplane racing.
I didn't expect that much discussion about it.
I have a lot of thoughts on this.
That was the closest we're going to get to a fight, I think. Did you exhaust your...
I've got a lot to fight about.
Yeah, okay. Did you exhaust your thoughts?
my main argument is, what else are they airing? Yeah,
it's a strong argument.
I want to come back to that one because that's an important argument.
Okay. Just revisit that throughout the show. Should we talk about burgers?
Oh, man. Should we talk about burgers?
So on Sunday, we went to the latest entrant in our search for Seattle's best burger, Giddy Up Burgers in Freelard. Whoa, that's not translating well to the audio format, that face you're making, but I think it was kind of a bitter beer face.
It was a bitter burger face. We're going to talk about, after this, a lot of great food from Seattle. This burger cannot be included in that list.
This is fascinating. So I happened to go, for whatever reason, I was searching through my email because I was trying to find the list of burger places we were going to. And I searched for Giddy Up Burgers. And an email came up where I referred to it as possibly Seattle's best burger.
Wow.
A couple years ago, I think probably when we went for your birthday. And I'm shocked at the magnitude of the change from that.
Okay, you feel the same way.
Well, I thought we had a really bad experience on Sunday because of the fact that the burger was like super cold.
It was cold?
That was my biggest complaint.
I don't know if I thought that it was cold. It just didn't taste like anything.
Huh.
To me, the main selling point of Giddy Up, because this is my third or fourth time, I thought that Giddy Up was a very good burger place. But this was by far the worst experience that I've had at Giddy Up.
So we ordered different burgers this time. What did you go with?
I went with, I don't know the name of it, but a burger that had bacon cooked into the burger patty and then bacon on top. It was tons of bacon, right?
Yeah, it's some, the name is something to do with pig. I forget exactly what it is.
And I've had that exact same burger before. And so my memory is that the thing that made Giddy Up stand out from other burger places is that the burger itself tasted excellent in the past. This time, it was flavorless, almost completely flavorless. There was nothing going on the burger. There's nothing that drew my attention in any way, no special sauce, nothing at all. They managed to make bacon taste mediocre.
You had the stuffed pig. I had the kitten caboodle, which is kind of the barbecue style, has barbecue sauce plus haystack onion rings, which to me were the standout. I love haystack onion rings. Oh, yeah. I'm all in on that. I thought a little low on sauce, even though I had both barbecue and ranch sauce, so therefore not a lot of
barbecue
flavor for that.
Barbecue and ranch are both on this burger?
Yeah.
And it was somehow low on sauce?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess there just wasn't enough of it.
Man, I'm not blaming you. I'm blaming them. You can almost never have too much sauce. And the thing that's really stood out to me about some of the previous burger places that we've been to that I think rank pretty high, Great State and Zippy's, which now by comparison look a little bit better, is the way that they would get that like melted cheese, right?
Oh, you gotta have the melted cheese.
Just that amazing cheese flavor, right? And this had none of that. I'm not even sure if there was cheese on the burger.
So it's interesting. I think I've been all over the board with my rating for Giddy Up. I started out at like an 88, 89.
Oh, man. And then I'm nowhere near
Then that. I talked myself down into an 86, partially because of the price. It's a little it's on the expensive
not
side for these
burgers. A
little
on the expensive side. It is basically, prices are commensurate with local burger place Red Robin.
No, I think it's more than that because it's a $10 burger. And if, at Red Robin, you pay $10, but you're getting bottomless fries. Now, they're steak fries, so they're extremely disappointing. But still, they are bottomless.
Almost no place that you go and order from a counter should be more expensive than a sit-down burger restaurant.
Yeah, that's fair.
You didn't respond at all to my local burger place Red Robin comment.
No, I do. Yeah, you slipped that one right by me.
Okay. So each burger is, I would say, about $3 too expensive. The kids burger, which is literally just a burger patty on a bun, a very depressing looking burger patty on a bun, was $5.50.
Although you did get them to bring you an unmelted slice of cheese to put on the top.
Yeah, the service.
Because otherwise Baby Fantasy Genius was not eating that plain burger.
Also, how much were beers? $6.50?
I don't know.
Beer is $1.50 more than it should be. I will comfortably pay $5 for beer. Right?
Uh-huh.
I'm willing to go six in some scenarios, right? So it's at least 50 cents too expensive. The burgers themselves were about $3 too expensive. Overall, the whole meal for three people was like $15 too expensive.
Yeah.
So Zippy's, three people, the exact same three people, I think our total meal was $20. And here it was $50.
Wow.
That's insane, right?
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's an enormous difference.
Maybe it was 30 at Zippy's, but...
That seems more reasonable. 20 seems on the cheap, so too low. All right, where did you end up as far as a rating?
75.
75. Wow, far and away the worst rating that either of us has given throughout the course of this. I still ended up in 86. Because I felt like this last visit wasn't to me necessarily representative. So I gave it a little bit of the benefit of the doubt from that standpoint.
I mean, I'll accept that. I thought about... I want to be harsh on these burger rankings.
I'm concerned that there's going to be a distinct lack of variation in my burger rankings.
Yeah, basically everything is going to be there. Like, I understand in the past I've had much better experiences at Giddy Up. This just wasn't one of them, and this happened to be the time that we're really judging burgers critically.
Yeah. It's basically like the reviewer's visit.
They should have known. We should have known that we were there.
We wield that kind of weight. The literally dozens of listeners to this podcast.
Where should we go this week?
I don't know. I'm open.
Okay, I'm thinking we should go to Unita Burger this weekend.
Unita is good. There was a place that I was thinking, I mean,
I added one to the list.
Did you? What?
I added a burger place called Feed Company to the list.
Okay. I was thinking that maybe this is a place that we can go pretty easily, and so it's not necessarily a good place to go in a time where, you know, we're not pressed for it, but I did kind of feel like we should go to Dick's in honor of this week's news, and here we have to toast again.
Hello!
Congratulations to the South winning the competition, the online voting for the next location of Dick's.
Finally!
Yeah.
I don't think we should go to Dick's. For the record, I think we should go to Dick's last. But
that's not a bad idea.
This has been in my mind. We'll go there like next November or something. But we're going to do Unita Burger this week for anybody who's like to eat along. But maybe if we wait long enough to go to Dick's, we'll go to the Dick's in the South End.
Yeah, no, I hope it's not going to be that long. They said end of 2018 is when they play. Late 2018 is when
late
they hope to open.
Late 2018.
We also don't know the
Give
exact
time.
The exact location. They have listed a variety of cities in the South End, all the way from Burien, Renton, of course, all the way down to, I think, Federal Way in Auburn, which would be too far south.
Yeah, no, I'd be out on that.
Yeah.
It's not going to Federal Way in Auburn. Come on. There's no way.
I mean, Edmonds is pretty far north.
Do you have any predictions?
Do I have a prediction? I know. I don't know.
I think this Dick's is going to Burien.
You think so? I mean, yeah. It doesn't seem like there'd be a lot of competition for it in Burien. It seems like it'd be good from that standpoint. But I kind of think Tequila. Because I think there's a lot of land in Tequila. People are already there. It's a central location, close to all the freeways. That's where I'm predicting.
Don't you think there's a lot going on in Tequila, though?
There is.
Here's the locations again, if you're curious. West Seattle, Auburn, Renton, Burien, SeaTac, Tequila, Kent, Normandy Park, Des Moines, and Federal Way.
West Seattle is also an interesting option there.
Yeah, West Seattle's a strong candidate.
Because you think about West Seattle, it basically is an island. Where, like, if you live in West Seattle, unless you're going into work, like, you generally hang out in West Seattle. So you're not, like, going to other Dick's.
Do you feel like it being in West Seattle is kind of against the integrity of it being in the South, though?
I mean, it's in the South. I would say no. It would be disappointing to me personally, because I'm less likely to go there.
It'd be farther than going to Queen Anne. Man, if they put that Dick's right next to the Brewmaster's Tap Room in Renton.
You would never need to leave. Yeah. Well, what else would you need?
I'll say Renton is just like West Seattle. It's an island. You never leave. But this is huge news.
It is, and still very exciting, wherever it ends up. Very exciting news. And to our listeners on the East Side who are disappointed on this result, the good news is, I think if they're successful, we've seen they'll probably revisit this again. I don't know what other options they'll put in the vote next time.
This is like the only company that actually leaves things up to fan vote.
Well, you know, you could have a conspiracy theory that they didn't actually go by fan vote, and they're just trying to, like, have you ever heard the conspiracy theory that they were going to, they named the Sounders the Sounders. That wasn't one of the options in the fan vote they had for the team name.
Really?
I don't know if you recall this. It was like Seattle FC and other names along that side, that line. And the theory was they left it out so people would get upset and would be excited when they named them the Sounders. That's the conspiracy theory.
I guess I'm good at that conspiracy theory.
If this were the True Hoop Pod, we'd throw the conspiracy music in right now.
Oh. Should we talk about other food, though? Because you and I had bad burgers this week, but we had excellent non-burger food.
That is accurate. You want to go first?
Well, so one place that I went to this weekend that I want to talk about is a place called Asadera Sinaloa.
I like you pause there as if you were like preparing yourself for the pronunciation of that.
You got to prepare yourself.
And then I think you slightly mispronounced it.
So I went to there are a couple of these. I think there's one in Ballard and then one in Kent, the original location in Kent. And it's Mexican style marinated meat.
Yes.
And it is up my alley. It's almost like they had the location in Kent and they were like, oh my God, white people like this. They're like, we got to make money. So they went straight to Ballard.
Well, it was either that or South Lake Union.
The Kent location, right? It's insanely packed. It's a small location. Always packed. There's a long wait. We waited for like 40 minutes.
I mean, it may not always be packed. I've only been there once. You've only been there once.
Always packed.
You also did go on a Saturday night.
Saturday night at like 7 o'clock.
I went weirdly enough.
I'm going to go ahead and project that out to every single other time.
Thursday at 3, just wide out the door. I went on Sunday night, oddly enough, after the Seafair hydroplane races.
Wow. After you what? No.
That did not watch on TV, no.
You were there.
And I went with our aunt and uncle and our mom and our grandpa. And they're the kind of people who generally prefer Americanized Mexican food.
Yes.
So I don't think they were ready for what was in store for them.
I can tell you who was ready for what was in store for them.
Oh, was it you?
That was me. It was so good. Okay, so the first issue, there was one issue. There's a long wait, right? And it's in this like nondescript business park in something called the West Hill of Kent, which I have never been to before.
Yeah, I'm still not convinced that that's what it is. I actually think it's, I actually thought it was in Des Moines the whole time, but
it's more or less Des Moines. I don't even know. Like, you're just driving. I'm following Google Maps. I have no idea what's going on out there. It's a place that if the new Dix goes there, I will not be able to find it. But so there's a long wait and then nowhere to go while you're waiting.
Yeah.
It really pushed the boundaries of what stores I was willing to go in to not have to wait outside in the cold. Because there's nowhere to wait inside.
Oh, and see, it was also nice and warm when I was there. That was the upside.
Also, I Googled a lot. I did a lot of Googling about the legality of drinking in your car. If the car was turned off.
That's legal, right?
I don't think it is.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it's not. That's what I came to. It didn't seem to be worth the risk. But there's a corner store, and I was like, we could just get beer at the corner store and then drink it in our cars. This is something that I've done so much in my entire life, but all of a sudden now I'm scared.
We need to figure out a play here.
I've become an old man. The play is going to get alcohol at the corner store and sitting outside and drinking it.
No, the play is getting
the strange neighborhood. I don't know what's going on.
The play has got to be getting the food takeout and then finding some other place to eat it.
All right, that might not be a bad play.
Yeah.
So I did not, because I'm an old man now, apparently, just like you, did not drink outside, did not drink in my car, did not even purchase a Miller High Life 32-ounce bottle.
Wow. But you did watch a hydroplane race.
The meat, though, is the real star. So you get in it like a asada platter. That's definitely the thing to get if you go there. And it comes on a cutting board with a very sharp knife.
That's how you know
knife,
it's good.
A full pound of steak. Perfectly marinated. So much flavor. And also with a sausage for some reason.
Yep. Yep.
Unclear why the sausage is even included, but no one is complaining. And then the perfect freshly made tortillas, right?
Yep.
Homemade fresh tortillas. Each one tasted so delicious. And you can slice up your meat and put it into an amazing tortilla yourself. It was excellent.
Yeah.
Did you have, you had the same response when you went there?
I did, yeah.
It was too good. I mean, I would highly recommend this to anybody who's interested in a large platter of meat.
I'm curious to see about the location in Ballard and see if it's the same.
I think there's still meat there.
You would assume, certainly.
I think it's very popular. Where did you eat this week?
So I went to a fusion sandwich. I guess it's primarily famous for its sandwich. Fusion Korean Vietnamese Tex-Mex restaurant called Pharrell, which is located in a grocery store in South Park.
Yes.
About 5 minutes from my home.
Your definition of grocery store is very loose.
No, it's...
It's like a corner store.
I suppose so. I don't think we have bodegas in Seattle, but if anywhere was, I guess it was good. It would be South Park. So yeah, it's kind of a random location. There used to be like a tortas place there that I went to one time. It was not that great. So upgrade here. And 4.5 stars on Yelp, has been reviewed positively in the Seattle Times, Eater, Zagat, I think, reviewed it. Like, This is like the spot, apparently. Yeah. Although there was, although
a
weirdly,
2 minute drive from your house.
Yeah. Although weirdly there was this, they said there was like a half hour wait between 12 and 2 because of the lunch crowd. We went at 11:30. There was no one there. Just us.
You beat the lunch crowd.
We did. Yeah.
You don't get off until 12.
No, it was very, very specific timing, apparently. And so what I had in terms of the sandwiches that they have are made on Mexican bread that's freshly baked at a bakery like right next door.
Okay. Okay.
Right down the street, very nearby. And then it's kind of banh mi style, but then the meat is, you've got a variety of options, but it can be kind of more barbecued as far as the Tex-Mex aspect of it.
Okay. I'm so in on this.
Yeah.
I want this so bad.
Yeah. So I went with the spicy pork option here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then like a spicy mayo sauce. It was really quite good. And the bread was phenomenal.
Man, I can't believe that you haven't been here before.
I just really learned about it. Like, I'd seen signs for it. I go to like the taco truck that's across the street from it on a regular basis, but I didn't really understand that what was going on until our mom, of all people, sold us on it. Yeah. She described it as one of the best sandwiches she'd ever had in her life.
No, when she liked the sandwich, that's when I knew it was good.
Right. Cause she's not the world's most adventurous eater.
She doesn't like good food. So when she said that sandwich was good, I knew that it was very good.
The one I had, by the way, was de fuego. The other options...
I can't believe that you had something called a fuego. The pork wasn't too spicy for you?
No, it wasn't that spicy. The gringo, which is kind of like their version of a Philly cheesesteak. The kogi, which has ribeye. The gaucho, which is barbecue pork. Very interested in that. And then the cockatoo... breaded fried chicken. They also have pho there along with the lines of the name and kind of like a fusion take on it. And then I think I really need to go back because I didn't try
their... Wait, they have pho at the sandwich place?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't try their spicy pork egg rolls and then their wings I want to try. I was confused by the fact that apparently they're off menu. Even though they're listed on the website, but they're off menu in the store. So I was like, okay, they must just not have these.
Yeah.
So...
Well, that goes along with my interest in things that are off menu.
Oh, yeah. You always got to go off menu. Man. But excited to try this more, especially because it's so close.
It feels like this week, you never went to the soy place?
I did not. Had to reschedule for lunch, so maybe in the next couple weeks here.
Okay, I did want to give one quick mention that also this week, we've just been nonstop eating. It's like really what we've been focused on. There's not, you know, the Seahawks aren't playing. There's no football going on. There's no basketball team that I care about. 100% focus on eating. But I did want to say that I had the best Reuben that I've ever had in my entire life.
Really?
Yes. At Market House Meats. It's like a block away from the historic Paramount Theater.
Seattle's historic
Paramount Theater. And I've never been there. I've walked by this place and it says corned beef in giant letters. Letters as big as I am along the side. And for some reason, I hadn't walked inside.
That's crazy.
Until loyal listener, I don't lion butt, tweeted and asked if we'd been there. And it was just like, why have I not been to this place? It's kind of a classic deli. I think it's been there since 48 years, I'm pretty sure. Maybe since 1940.
Wait, so it's been there that whole time?
Yeah, it's been there that whole time. I've been working at the Paramount that whole time.
Wow.
I've never been inside.
Huh.
But it was by far the best Reuben sandwich that I've ever had. Not even close. And it was huge. I was saying that on my way there, I was worried it wouldn't be enough food.
Uh-huh.
And my coworker, when she saw it, because I was like, I could probably eat more. She's like, if you can eat more than that, you definitely have a tapeworm.
Well, that's good to know. I look forward to trying that myself.
That's our edition of food news.
Yeah.
Let's end Potencast food news. Wait, you have more food news?
Well, we're here because of the fact that the winners, of course, get the Zibby's gift certificate. Take a look at the latest leaderboard for the Potencast bracket challenge.
Okay, how are things looking?
Our cousin Katie is currently leading on the men's tournament side, and with 930 points ahead of my former coworker George. But you know who still has a chance to win here?
Who?
Baby Fantasy Genius
in the men's?
Yeah.
What he does?
Yeah, if Gonzaga beats
South Carolina.
Does he have South Carolina? No. If Gonzaga beats North Carolina in the final,
then he wins.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Or I think if Oregon wins and Gonzaga wins the title, then he would also win, I think.
Really?
I'm not doing all this math off the top of my head, but that's what it's looking like right now.
Oh, I thought he was out. I was like, the women's tournament is your only shot, kid.
Wow.
And he's not looking good in the women's tournament.
He's not. Because of the fact that two number two seeds actually made the final four on the women's side.
If a four-year-old wins the men's tournament over 40 people, that's going to be amazing.
Yeah. On the women's side, I'm pretty sure it's our loyal listener, Noah, that's leading right now. But he has UW winning the title.
Oh, no.
So
I don't like their odds.
If UConn wins, then it will be Raj who will take the title by 10 points ahead of loyal listener Chris. Or disloyal Lon Nistler?
No, I think he's a loyal listener now.
Okay.
And also joined us at Giddy Up.
Yes, that is true. Baby Fantasy Genius has UConn over South Carolina in the final. So I think someone else who's ahead of him also has that. I think Raj also has that. So therefore, Baby Fantasy Genius cannot possibly win.
Oh, he's been eliminated.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no, I guess that's not true. Raj has UConn over Stanford, so this is really exciting that I looked this
really
up
here. Good stuff. So if Baby Fantasy Genius, if he wins either the men's or the women's pool, we have to have him on to talk about what his plans are for the $20 to Zippies, because he thinks that he can spend that $20 to Zippies just on the, like, video games that they have there. He wants to basically spend $1.50 on an animal drink and then spend $18.50 on video games.
You know what? I think we got to let him do it if he wants to.
I don't know if we'll use that with the gift certificate.
But we'll use the gift certificate.
I have to explain to him that it says no cash value on it.
We'll use the gift certificate and then let him have the money.
Okay. I'll be like, talk to Al about that.
I think that's the way to go. All right, where do you want to go next? Should we do our Mariners season preview?
Sure.
Okay.
I would love to do a Mariners season preview. So you've been paying attention to the Mariners, right? All spring, watching most of the games?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Been paying attention to the velocity readings and all that, the pitch tracker stuff.
Yeah, you're a regular Rick Riz. I don't know. So I want to look at the Mariners' coming season based upon kind of three main questions.
Okay.
Going into the season. And the first question being, you mentioned Felix. Number one.
Did I? I don't think I did.
Well, you said velocity.
I alluded to it.
The first question being, can we expect a bounce back season from Felix Hernandez?
After what was, inevitably, as he continues to age, the worst season of his career, but one that he benefited, it seemed like, from a lot of luck in terms of his batting average on balls in play that kind of masked that decline.
Well, and I think over time that caught up with him. But I've been reading a little bit about Felix, and an interesting trend that I've noticed, especially about baseball writing, I don't know if you've seen this, is that the talk of the town is about fly balls.
Is it?
And about how important fly balls are. And for Felix, it's a little bit about strike zone, too. So over time, the strike zone lowered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Felix was able to dominate through the 2000s based upon that.
Yes.
He was somebody who had, he was able to throw heat down in the strike zone. And it was a very important thing to do.
And he was able to force a lot of ground balls that way, right?
Keep
the ball out of the air.
Hitters have adjusted to that, though.
Yeah.
So over time, hitters all of a sudden last season really started hitting Felix on these pitches down in the zone. And in general, throughout the league, hitters became much better at hitting pitches that were down in the zone and hitting a lot more fly balls. So some of the better pitchers or pitchers who struggled, somebody who to look at is somebody like Justin Verlander, who had a bounce back season last year after having a couple of down years, were able to start putting their fastball high. And it's something that the Mariners have been working a little bit with Felix on trying to do this year, and having him hit those pitches instead of just pounding the bottom of the strike zone, instead getting his fastball up high. And it seems to have worked so far between the World Baseball Classic and spring training.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little tough to draw too strong conclusions from those handful of outings, but encouraging nonetheless. And then the other aspect of it is, the Mariners front office was kind of critical of his preparation and his conditioning going into last season, and that seems to have caused him to rededicate himself over the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's hard to judge. You don't want to look at spring training too much, right? I would say the spring training stats mean almost nothing. But you look at it, and he has a 0.77 whip for spring training. I think a 2.77 ERA so far. So he's looked very good so far. And I would say initially I thought maybe Felix was done.
Mm-hmm.
But then reading this and seeing that there have been other pitchers who've been able to adjust as they've gotten older, as they've lost their velocity, I think there's a chance that he might have at least one more good season in him.
Which would be nice. How are we feeling about the rest of the rotation, especially with Drew Smyly getting scratched for his final start of spring training on Friday?
Well, that doesn't look good. That's part of my second question.
Okay.
Is how does the team look different this year than they did last year?
Uh-huh.
And so one of those places is obviously starting pitching, because they traded Taijuan Walker over the offseason for John Segura and Mitch Haniger. We're going to get back to Mitch Haniger.
Oh, are we?
Yeah. No, we're excited about Mitch Haniger.
Are we?
Yes. Oh, we are excited.
What position does he play?
He's going to play right field.
Okay.
He's a general outfielder, could play center field. But so the pitching staff has been a little bit remade. You had veteran starters who had rough seasons last year, and then a couple of young players who, one of whom, James Paxton, if he's healthy, took the leap and became close to maybe an elite-level starter. Pretty clearly the number two starter. You've got Felix, who's looking to potentially bounce back in the number one spot. Sasu Akuma, who had a rough year last year, has not looked good during spring training.
Yeah.
He's somebody who might... I mean, he's a finesse pitcher, but he might be on the other side of the wall.
I mean...
It might be over
for him. At his age, it wouldn't be surprising, would it?
No. But then, at the bottom of the rotation, they've kind of mixed it up a little bit, bringing in flyer players, which is I am very into. We've talked about this previously on the podcast.
Jerry DePoto making regression into the mean work for him.
That's what it's about. Giovanni Gallardo, somebody who penciled in right now as I think the number five starter, maybe even up to number four. Drew Smyly had a rough year last year. Drew Smyly coming off a down year. Players who, and he's having some arm troubles lately, Drew Smyly.
What was the expression that was used for
his arm was feeling a bit
soggy?
Soggy.
Not the word you were about to use. That is an unpleasant word.
I was going to say muddy.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say moist.
Moist arm. But I really like the idea of finding these pitchers who had down seasons. And like they said, make regression of the mean work for them, because that's what baseball is.
They didn't say that. I said that.
What they thought that. They just didn't have a catchy phrase like you have.
Gonna have to trademark it. Start selling shirts.
Hey, DePoto. That's you yelling at your DePoto.
What, like I don't know stands why. Yelling at him?
Unclear.
First off, how many Mariners games do you think I attend? Because it's not as many as you think.
Do you think Jerry DePoto attends?
Well, I think he attends a good number of them. I don't know where he's sitting. Probably not anywhere I can yell at him. Or would choose to. ESPN reporter yells at Mariners GM. Yeah.
Anyway, I really, really like what they've done with the bottom half of the rotation. There's another player, Dylan Overton, who they brought over. Kind of a friend. He's a lefty.
Saw that guy pitch while I was at the bar the other day.
Did you?
Yeah.
He's pitching in the bar?
No. It's on TV. It was on one of the mini TVs. As I was watching Clippers Jazz. That's what I was there for.
He's somebody who's might make the rotation if Drew Smyly doesn't. Kind of a fringe starter, bullpen guy, lefty specialist. But
he also reminded me a lot of the guy who sits next to us at Husky games. I don't know if you had that same thought.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I like what they've done with it. If Felix can have a big year, you've got James Paxton and Felix Hernandez, who look like, well, if Felix is what he could be, clear top-tier starters.
Yeah, I thought you had a line about ifs.
It's not an if. He's one of the best pitchers in baseball. I mean, saying that if Felix can be this, that's not the same thing as saying.
He's also, you know, I don't know what the equivalent to this would be. You know, if Paul Pierce can really get back to form for the playoffs, the Clippers are going to be a tough out. Okay, I mean, Felix is much better than Paul Pierce.
I really don't even understand this comparison.
I don't know. But yeah, I don't know that Felix winning the Cy Young is really relevant at this point in his career.
Okay. A couple of other places where the team looks a little bit different.
The outfield, right?
Is one, that's one place that they've really focused on kind of changing the direction of what they'd done before.
A lot of athleticism, a lot of defense.
And yeah. So they're probably going to be the first team since, I think, the 2013 Cleveland Indians to start three players in the outfield who the previous year had played more than 50 games at center field. They're starting three center fielders.
There's also a comparison to the 2003 Mariners.
Very similar. I mean, maybe not the same kind of... there's nobody like Mike Cameron, right? So in center field,
they have there's nobody as cool as Mike Cameron.
They have Leonis Martin in center field. In left field, Jerod Dyson. In right field, Mitch Haniger. All basically interchangeable at these positions and all very rangy outfielders. And that's that fly balls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So teams are looking for fly balls this season. That's what everybody is going after in modern baseball. And what better way to stop fly balls than having outfielders who can get to almost anything?
The 2003 outfield, for the record, by the way, Randy Winn in left.
Oh, man.
Cameron in center and obviously Ichiro in right.
Oh, Ichiro.
Did that come as a surprise to
you? Really? If you would ask me to name that outfield, I'd be like, Mike Cameron.
Seriously? You forgot the guy who won MVP 2 years earlier?
Hard-hitting Mark Witten was out there.
No.
Anyway.
No, Mark Witten never played center field. That is for damn sure.
Anyway, so they had an offense last year that was able to be pretty productive. When you have their core, the middle of the lineup, they added some hitting to that and potentially John Segura. But then going out in the outfield, clearly identifying that as a huge need is defense in the outfield.
All right, you had one other place that was different?
No, one other question.
Okay.
One other question, which is, what can we expect from this team?
Right? What can we expect from this team?
So I was looking at FanGraphs positional rankings, right?
Uh-huh.
So by position, I'll run through this quickly. Catcher, 11th. First base, 26th. Second base, 2nd. Shortstop, 13th. Third base, 6th. Left field, 14th. Center field, 20th. Right field, 17th. DH, 2. Starting pitching, 17th. Relief pitching, 8th. That's their rank among all the teams. So if you look at that, they're only in the bottom third in the league in two categories right now. In first base, which is the biggest question mark on the entire team.
Uh-huh.
There looks like they're going into the season with Danny Valencia, who they acquired this offseason from the A's. Not really what you would like to have as a first baseman. Obviously a place where the Mariners, if there's an opportunity there to go out and get a first baseman, probably will take it.
Uh-huh.
And that's the one position of need. They need a hitter there. They need somebody who can do something there. But then beyond that, the other position is center field. Maybe Leonis Martin is not up to the caliber defensively or maybe even offensively the other outfielders, but still very solid and like right on the cusp of not being in the bottom third. So they're a team that's very deep. Every single position, they have solid players, and in a couple positions, they have players who are near the top of the league, right?
Uh-huh.
They've got relatively deep starting pitching, or at least good possibilities at starting pitching. They've got a good bullpen that was kind of remade last year around Edwin Diaz. They have depth at almost every position also, right? So this offseason, Jerry DePoto was focused on building up depth, veteran players who can play in a lot of positions, did a lot of interesting stuff.
They did a lot of stuff.
So, I mean, it's hard not to feel good. That's how you should know that you shouldn't feel good, but it's hard not to feel good.
Yeah, Baseball Prospectus in their season preview just basically went over every time that the Mariners were like, we're going all in this year, this is the year, and it completely flamed out every single time.
Yep. Well, so the same Baseball Prospectus, if you look at their Pecota projections for the season, they have the Mariners at 86-76, solidly as the number one wild card, finishing second in the division after the Houston Astros.
Although I was surprised their playoff odds were not better given that, and I assume the reason is because of the fact that Houston is so far ahead in the AL West that the Mariners basically have to go the wild card route most of the time. So they only made it in about, I think, 50% of Baseball Prospectus' simulations.
That's pretty good.
That's true. Compared to not having made it since 2001, yes, it looks great. And then about 30% on FanGraphs of making the playoffs.
30% on FanGraphs?
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of reason to feel optimistic right now. There are places where if somebody doesn't perform up to their ability or what they're expecting, there are places where players can fill in for them, right? It's not like, I felt like that the Mariners season of the past, I always think about Eric Bedard,
yes. You know,
like they sold out their future in Adam Jones, who's now a star player in another team playing a position, but man, if he was in center field.
Adam Jones is still a star player because that Bedard trade was what, 2007?
That was just the worst trade.
It was before the 2008 season or 2009?
I don't think that this trade, the Taijuan Walker trade is anywhere comparable to that. I mean, look, Taijuan Walker may become a great player, but I don't really see it as a comparable trade. John Segura is not a pitcher who is going to get injured halfway through the season.
Yeah, 2008. I think I was at opening day when Eric Bedard started on opening day. I'm pretty sure that happened.
So, even if that happens, they haven't completely sold out the future. I mean, granted, this is not a young team.
No.
This is kind of their opportunity.
I was listening to Jerry DePoto on the Ringer's MLB show, and he was noting that it was the oldest position player group in baseball last year.
Really?
or at least in the American League.
But it does make sense why they look to put together a team. They looked for depth in a lot of places, tried to fill it out. They try to put together a team that's going to try to go for it this year.
And they got a lot younger in the process. So I think that's where, you know, as you say about not selling out for this year, that's where that seems true.
So are we good on baseball till September?
Yeah. This has been a lot of baseball talk. Where do we want to go next?
Let's go Sounders.
Should we go USMNT first?
How?
Because that's actually probably the real Sounders news. You know what? A toast to Deuce. Clint Tepsi, in his return to the national team for the first time since his regular heartbeat last summer.
Eight for the national team?
Yeah.
Ocho. Toast to Ocho.
He still goes by Deuce. It's not Ocho face. Scores a hat trick on Friday in their drubbing of Honduras in Bruce Arena's first competitive match as U.S. national team, or back as U.S. national team manager. That was a pretty exciting one. I was fairly convinced the U.S. was going to win the World Cup after that one. Then on Tuesday, they back it up, went down to Panama, and earned a 1-1 draw, and I think a solid performance, all things considered. If you draw on the road and win at home, you're going to advance easily. You know, you're going to qualify easily for the World Cup.
How many more so the USMNT now sits in fourth, which would put them into a playoff to get into the World Cup, correct? The top three teams automatically make it, and the fourth team goes into a playoff to compete after that?
Well, that sounds correct, but I would need to look it up on Wikipedia.
I mean, they're always competing. You know, I watched the Panama. I didn't watch the match that they won 6-0, but I watched that Panama match, and I didn't really feel great.
Did you? I mean, what was encouraging to me, I didn't see the first half of that one, but the second half I had on the screen as I was at the Blazers-Nuggets game.
It's crazy how much we have to talk about. We can't even talk about the Blazers.
We'll get to the Blazers next week, I think. But it's the fact that at the end it seemed like it was Panama that was playing for the draw and the U.S. that was attacking at the end of the match. That's what encouraged me.
That was what you took from that?
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like Panama dominated a lot of the second half. Like the play was all on their offensive side of the field.
There were some scary chances for Panama.
But at the end of it, the U.S. was really coming on strong.
And then what do the Sounders have this weekend?
Well, hey, let's spend a second more on this qualification here. The Hex, as it's known. So we're so far four matches in out of 10. And yes, the U.S. currently...
What is with all the panic? they had only played two matches?
Yeah, but it was a really bad two matches.
I thought they were almost eliminated.
No, panic was way too strong.
There was too much panic.
So they are 1 point behind Panama and have the better goal differential at this point, thanks to the domination of Honduras, with whom they're technically even in the standings, both on 4 points.
So it looked pretty good for the World Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a very encouraging weekend for the USMNT.
I think I was confused about how many matches they played.
We didn't mention that Dempsey, in addition to the hat trick against Honduras, also scored the one goal down in Panama. And then later got into it, mixed it up a little with Roman Torres. Did you see that?
He had a lot of aggression to take out on Roman Torres, was waiting for the right opportunity.
So the one person who was not
involved... I was like, why have you made any insane mistake here, Roman Torres?
You're much farther down on Roman Torres than I am. One player who was not in action for the USMNT this weekend was Jordan Morris, who returned back to Seattle with the sprained ankle that he suffered during their win over the New York Red Bulls last week. So status still unclear for this. They play this Friday against Atlanta United. Before this, they did have that friendly against Necaxa, the Mexican side, and drew 1-1, giving up a goal late stages of that to equalize after Alvaro Fernandez scored the goal for
Sounds
the Sounders.
Like thrilling stuff.
It was basically an opportunity for some reserves to get some playing time.
This Friday against Atlanta United.
So Atlanta United...
You're not going to this match.
Are you?
Yeah.
Nice. Is this the first time the Sounders have ever played on a Friday? I can't remember it.
Almost surely not, but yeah, it's okay.
I can't ever remember it happening. Atlanta comes in as an expansion team, 2-1-0 so far, or 2-0-1 so far. Have scored an MLS high 11 goal or MLS high 3.7 goals per game. They are second in terms of total goals because a couple teams played a fourth game over the weekend, whereas most teams had the weekend off, as Atlanta and Seattle both did. They're coached by the former Argentina national team coach, Tata Martino, who also, for one season, coached Barcelona.
How is that true? How did that happen?
He after that was coaching the Argentina national team and resigned after the most recent centenario, Copa America centenario. And
was he their manager during the World Cup?
Let's see the timing of that. I don't think so. I think he just took over for the back-to-back Copas.
Okay.
It is my understanding of that. But then after that, took this job. And an example of Atlanta kind of spending big in the effort to be successful right away. Favors a high-pressing, attack-minded style, as you can tell from that that goals total. But they've also only conceded 3 times so far. They're eventually going to have Brad Guzan as their keeper. He's still busy finishing out his season in the EPL. So they're starting their inexperienced Georgia native backup, Alec Khan, who leads the MLS so far with 13 saves and has given up just 3 goals in 3 games. So he's been pretty impressive. But here's the thing. 2 things, I think. First off, if you look at the expected goals on 538 using their method, they've only been expected to score about 4 goals based on their shot location and shot type, like the part of the body that was used on the shot. And they've actually scored 11. So it seems like they've maybe been a bit fortunate. And also they played their fellow expansion brethren, Minnesota, which has not been as good so far.
And they scored like 6 goals in that match.
Yes, they won 6-0 in that one. And then also their forward, Yosef Martinez, who is the leading MLS scorer with 5 goals so far this season, is out 4 to 6 weeks after suffering a quad strain playing for the Venezuelan national team. So that's going to be a big adjustment for their attack this week.
So, I mean, I have to be feeling good about the Sounders for this match, depending on who plays.
First off, I'm feeling good about the Sounders in general.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think that this is a good time to play Atlanta. You want to play them while the leading scorer in the MLS is injured. My analysis.
It's been 3 games. But a good opportunity to pick up 3 points here.
Yeah.
And then what about the Sonics? Any arena news?
So this Monday was the first meeting of the Seattle City Council's Select Committee on Civic Arenas. And the main news that came out of that was that the Seattle Center is requesting landmark status for 7 buildings, including Key Arena. That itself was not surprising. Knew that that was going to be the case. And that's why the proposals that the city sought from developers had to include the option for, you know, strictly renovating as opposed to simply entirely rebuilding in that area. Now, if some of the other buildings around there were declared landmarks, that would reduce the footprint you'd have available to build.
Is the Vera Project one of them? Is that a landmark? No,
the Vera Project is safe either way.
Okay.
The buildings to the north of the arena are safe either way. This is some of this. There's like it's where the team shop is. There's a storage building behind that.
Those are landmarks? The team shop? I don't know. Squatch might have made fun of me in there one time.
I don't know what to tell you here. They requested landmark status. It complicates things a little, but it's unclear how much.
What was the logic behind that?
That they're related to the World's Fair and therefore they're historic.
But there's no Sonics logic to it?
No. No, I don't think so.
The team shop?
Yep.
Is related to the World's Fair?
I mean, all these buildings were built for the World's Fair and then eventually repurposed to what they have become now. So,
okay,
there you go. We'll see. We'll follow along with that. Of course, coming up on the deadline for that request for proposals from the city that presumably the Oakview Group and AEG will be responding to, that's April 12th. And then the next meeting of this Select Committee on Civic Arenas will be April 17th following that. So I think that's pretty much it there.
Okay. Husky basketball. Husky men's basketball.
So the coaching staff starting to take shape for Mike Hopkins. We knew last week that Will Conroy was going to stay on as assistant and got the news over the weekend that Cameron Dollar will indeed be coming back to UW to work under Hopkins. You have no comment on this?
I have no comment on this.
No comment on this.
I have no comment on anything.
What?
My comment on every single thing is thanks, Jen Cohen.
You know, I'm going next week down to Portland for the... We'll have a podcast before this, but I don't know if we'll talk about going down for the Hoop Summit, and Michael Porter will be there, and it's just going to like twist the knife every single time I see him play down in Portland.
Thanks, Jen Cohen.
Jason Hart will not be joining the coaching staff. He's staying at USC after they offered him a raise because of UW's offer to him. So, you know, we'll see how Hopkins fills out the third spot in the staff. But I'm excited about Dollar coming back, not only because of his ties.
Are you really excited about Dollar coming back?
Yeah, he was a valuable assistant, which is why he became a head coach at Seattle U. And his head coaching experience, I think, is valuable when you're dealing with a guy and a first-time head coach in Mike Hopkins who has 9 games of coaching experience. So having that on the bench, I think, will be a good thing.
Great.
among the... Okay, the...
I like... It's funny that you're the positive one now.
Yeah, well, because of the fact that I'm not... You're, like, way down...
I'm way down because of the news you're going to get to.
Among the current players, we've heard that David Crisp, Dominic Green, Carlos Johnson, Matisse Thybulle, they have all either tweeted or said that they are staying. Noah Dickerson requested his release, still up in the air whether he will transfer or not. And, you know, insiders, I think, optimistic that he will remain at UW. And, you know, it's interesting. Well, let's talk about the recruits here. So, Michael Porter officially announced last week that he is headed to Missouri after they hired his dad as an assistant coach, surprising absolutely no one.
It's crazy that we saw this coming for so long. The only thing we didn't see is we thought it might have been Lorenzo at Missouri. We didn't see the Konzo Martin aspect.
Did not see that aspect of it, no. But everything else. And you know what? I read an article about the Porters from like...
Was it about how we didn't want them?
No, it was not that. It was from when Michael was a sophomore and like about their ties to the Columbia area. It's like, you know what? This even makes more sense now. Like if it wasn't Lorenzo Romar, who is Michael Porter Jr.'s godfather, there is no way they ever would have left Missouri. Like they were going to go there for sure.
Yeah.
The two sisters still on the women's basketball team. And they're just going to have they're going to have so many Porters at Missouri now. I also had forgotten that, the Michael Porter Sr.'s wife, Lisa, her sister is the head coach of the Missouri women's team.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's really all in the family there.
I almost feel good for them.
Yeah. No, I do. You know,
happy they get to go back home.
Yeah. So among the other recruits, Blake Harris.
Thanks, Jenko.
Blake Harris has explored his options. Is Mamadou Diarra. We'll see what happens as those twos play out. And then Dejon Davis, according to a Jeff Goodman report earlier today, leaning towards Stanford at this point after receiving his release from UW.
That one, that stings the most.
Stanford.
Who's left? Anybody?
Well, Jalen Noel is
just Jalen Noel. He's happy. He's feeling good. You know that after all these other guys leave, Jalen Noel's leaving.
I mean, you know.
We're going to be watching a lot of Carlos Johnson next year.
At this point, though, I'm looking at the recruiting class on ESPN, and Jalen is the only player listed.
Really happy that Dominic Green's coming back. Yeah.
So.
Let's just say Mike Hopkins has his work cut out for him.
It's going to be a long process, as I think we have maintained all along about this. I think it's interesting to contrast the fact that so many current players have basically recommitted in a way as opposed to the recruits.
It's a lot more difficult for current players to leave.
Yeah, and also you have more ties to each other on the roster. You have more ties to the school, everything like that. You have friends at the school. You're going to have to sit out a year in all likelihood. So I think it doesn't surprise me thinking about that so many of the current players have decided to stay and so many of the recruits at this point don't look like they're going to stay.
Well, the good news is both Gonzaga and Oregon are in the Final Four.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Made it on the same day, too, as I was in Portland. What a great day
Was Portland excited?
Portland was very excited. I think they were more excited about that than the Blazers game against the Timberwolves at that point.
Do you want to know, who do they love more, Oregon or Nurkic?
Yusuf Nurkic? No, they love Nurkic more.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
There better be a Nurkic donut coming soon.
Oh, that's a good idea. They haven't done that. They need to get on that. One other UW thing. Did you see my link earlier this week?
I did. I downloaded the podcast, but have not listened.
So Bobby Jones is a friend of one of the contributors to the True Hoop podcast, Black Trey. And he appeared on the Monday show this week, Black Opinions Matter Monday, and I was invited to come on for a 15-minute segment.
a brief segment. You can't be on Black Opinions Matter Monday for too long.
To talk about Husky hoops with Bobby Jones. So that was a really good time, and I suggest everyone who's a Husky fan check that out. And Bobby Jones
does he now go by Bobby Roy Jones Jr.?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, it seems very complicated. There's all sorts of names. Am I wrong about this?
Well, like, international stuff will often list players by their full name, including their middle name. So maybe you were seeing that? I don't know. Is that how he was listed on the pod?
That's how he was listed on the pod.
I don't know. I don't control that. Anyway, Bobby Jones also tells the story of when he nearly had a triple-double in his first career start against the Sonics and Kevin Durant his last season, which sadly I was not around for that portion of it because I remember watching that game.
What team was he on at the time?
The Memphis Grizzlies, one of the five teams he played for that season, an NBA record. And
he played for five teams in the season?
He did, yeah. So a lot of it, he had a lot of interesting stuff. They also discussed growing up in Compton, the guys they played with, etc. So a fun podcast to listen to.
When is he going to be on the Pelton cast?
I may have to ask at some point. We'll see.
Would that be fun? I was thinking of that when you had him on there. I was like, I feel like Bobby Jones would maybe come on this podcast.
I had some. He said that the True Podcast was the first podcast he'd ever done. So really, we should have gotten him earlier.
Yeah, Bobby Ray Jones Jr., the many faces of Bobby. I'm like, who the hell is Bobby Ray Jones Jr.?
I guess it's to distinguish him from the Philadelphia 76ers, like the defensive specialist Bobby Jones, who played for them in the 80s.
What? Okay. To us, he's just Bobby Jones.
Yes. One other piece of college basketball news. Seattle University announced a replacement for Cameron Dollar today. They hired Jim Hayford from Eastern Washington, which I think is a pretty good hire for them. He's done a really nice job at Eastern, built some good offenses, previously was at Whitworth. So, you know, strong ties to local basketball. And, you know, I had someone who texted me saying they were surprised that he took this job because it was unclear to them that Seattle U was a step up from Eastern. But I pointed out that recruiting to Seattle is probably easier than recruiting guys to Cheney.
Cheney.
Yeah.
Be like, remember when the Seahawks trained here?
We've got red turf.
Do they have a red court?
I don't think they do, no.
Michael Ruse better step his game up. What do we talk to Bobby Jones about?
I mean, I had some questions that I left unanswered there. Like, you know, kind of how he was recruited. I don't know. Talking just memories. You know.
I imagine it being like the Chris Farley show.
Do you remember that time?
You remember Trey Simmons?
Oh, I didn't get to ask about Trey Simmons because Trey Simmons, I think, is a little bit too much of a deep cut for the national audience. But a Husky audience is going to want to talk about how great Trey Simmons was.
With Bobby Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to be great. So look out for our upcoming podcast with Bobby Jones, Bobby Ray Jones Jr.
Well, first off, we'll refer to him however he wants to be referred to.
We're the only people who even know who Bobby Jones is, it feels like.
Our cousin.
Yeah, just for Katie. Okay, if she wins the Peltoncast tournament challenge, then we'll have Bobby Jones on. And then Husky women's basketball ending their season and Kelsey Plum's Husky career this last year.
And Chantel Osahor's career as well. So 75-64 loss to Mississippi State in Oklahoma City, a game that was really weird. So we talked about last week how Mississippi State was bringing their starters off their bench. So because of that, the Huskies dominated the start of this game and dominated the third quarter and then just got destroyed in the second and fourth quarter.
Maybe this is a brilliant plan. Maybe Mississippi State wins basketball.
I mean, I guess it is a brilliant plan because they ended up upsetting Baylor and getting to the Final Four. So
I think they might have figured out basketball.
Although, especially because the one starter they left in the starting lineup scored 41 points against Baylor to lead them to the Final Four. A Kelsey Plum-esque performance. But the other thing that happened is one of the players who did move into the lineup was Tierra McCowan, who was the sixth woman of the year in the SEC this year, and is 6'7". And it turns out that 6'7" is much taller than Chantel Osahor, who had tough time keeping up with her. And McCowan scored, I think, 20 points and had 7 rebounds and 3 blocks in the fourth quarter.
Oh, man.
As Mississippi State came from behind to win this game.
Two questions for you.
Okay.
Question number one. What are Kelsey Plum and Chantel Osahor's draft prospects for the WNBA?
So Plum could be the number one pick in the draft. What's interesting is the two other legitimate contenders are both players who have...
Are they the all-time leading scorers?
No, neither of them are. But they're both players who have a year of eligibility left and have to declare whether they're going to enter the draft.
You can do that?
if you're 22 the year of the draft, you can. So Diamond DeShields, who's Delino DeShields' daughter.
Oh, really?
Plays at Tennessee. She was a transfer, so therefore she's already completed 4 years. She can enter. Everyone pretty much is. I don't think she's announced it officially, but everyone assumes she will. And a lot of people think that she's got a good chance to be the number one pick, even though she was much less productive statistically as a college player.
I mean, and then you pretty much have to be.
The other player is Kelsey Mitchell from Ohio State, who
Not even the best Kelsey in the draft.
An old junior, has an outside chance if she comes back to pass Plum and become the all-time leading scorer.
Really?
Yeah.
How easy is it to be the all-time leading scorer?
It's not that easy, but for some reason, Kelsey's are doing it right now. So that's one factor in why she might not come out. Also, her dad is an assistant coach at Ohio State, so that might keep her here. So we'll see. I think she's considered the consensus top player. DeShields and Plum, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder on those two. But no worse than third. Osahor is a more interesting case because, you know, obviously such a productive college player, but she's undersized. Her lack of mobility is, I think, going to be an issue for her in the WNBA much more so than in the college game. So, you know, second round, third round.
There are three rounds.
Yeah.
Where are the Storm going to pick?
The Storm does not have a first-round pick. They traded that. Their first pick is number 15 overall.
So almost no chance for Kelsey Plum to come to Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, it would require a trade, and I don't see that in the works.
Man, doesn't she feel like the perfect heir apparent to Sue Bird?
She does, yes. But, you know, they don't have the pick.
Okay.
So, such is life.
Question number two is, how does the program look for next year without Kelsey Plum and Chantal Azar?
I mean, it's obviously going to be a big drop-off. Like, they played 40 minutes a game a lot of the time. You know,
yes.
Plum was never left the court. Osahor played a lot of minutes. And they were the leading rebounder and scorer in the country. Like, look, it's going to be a big drop-off. Getting Natalie Romeo in as a transfer helps a little bit. She provided some scoring punch this year. Arian McDonald had a really nice freshman season. I think she's going to have the ball in her hands a lot next year without Plum. And then, you know, they're counting on some younger players to step up. Deja Strother is kind of like the interior version of Osahor, another, you know, big physical post player who probably will see a lot more action. They like this year's freshman class that didn't play a lot of minutes besides McDonald, but I think they expect them to step into larger roles. And then we'll see what they're able to do in terms of recruiting.
Okay. Should we wrap things up with the Seahawks?
We should.
Not a ton of Seahawks news this week.
Well, a handful of signings, three linebackers in the last week since we last podcasted. Former San Francisco 49er Michael Wilhoit signed to a one-year, $1.5 million contract with $500,000 guaranteed. Then linebacker Terrence Garvin, and then also Dewey McDonald, who was an exclusive rights free agent for the Seahawks, who they converted from safety to linebacker, re-signed. And, you know, both Pete Carroll and John Schneider talked about competition at the linebacker spot. And, yeah.
As they do. They talked about competition at most every spot.
They did, but like they put their money where their mouth is in terms of going out and signing guys at linebacker. So, you know, we'll see.
It's basically competition for one spot.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, two starting spots are settled. And, you know, in terms of Bobby Wagner and KJ Wright, it's just that weak side linebacker spot that doesn't even play that much at this point, as much nickel as the Seahawks play. But, you know, they're clearly wanting to have some options at that position if they don't re-sign Mike Morgan. And then all of these guys will, including Arthur Brown, who had previously been signed and will stay at middle linebacker, all of them will contribute on special teams or be in the mix there.
And then aside from that, a little bit of clarity of what Pete and John see the line looking like next year.
Yeah, and you know, I think kind of along the lines of what you talked about, I guess Odeabushi had not signed at the time we kind of discussed
when we did our perfect lines.
Yeah, so you know, talked about a competition between George Fant and Luke Jokel at left tackle, and Pete Carroll said something we talked about that.
Which, if Luke Jokel loses that competition,
no, if he loses that competition,
then they just set $7 million.
That means he's going to left guard.
Yes,
Glowinski's going to right guard. So basically, George Fant is competing with Odeabushi and maybe with Gary Gilliam, because it sounds like Jermaine Ifedi is going to slide out to right tackle to start. You know, we'll see how that works. He could end up back at right guard. Our loyal listener, Ben B., had some good tweets about scouting Abushi and looking at his film and about how effective he is as a pass blocker. A little bit questionable as a run blocker, which, are we sure he plays for the Seahawks?
I'm very in on Odeyabushi.
I thought it was interesting. Did you see John Schneider's comments about how they used analytics to cite him?
Yeah, I love that. It's just like
Theo Epstein stuff. I have no idea what that means.
I feel a little bit bad for Billy Beane, first off, that it's all of a sudden called the Theo Epstein stuff.
Well, Billy Beane didn't just lead the Cubs and the Reds, having already previously led the Red Sox to a World Series title.
Second off, I am so fascinated what these analytics are.
Me too. It's a blank slate.
I think they might have used hashtag analytics to sign
Look, him. I trust them. I trust them on this one.
I understand it from some perspective, which is they got a lineman with starting experience relatively cheap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, from that standpoint, for sure.
I don't know if I'd call that analytics per se, but it's something.
It was interesting to again hear Carroll and Shire tout the value of continuity on the offensive line when, as people have pointed out, it's possible that if Effetti starts at right tackle and Ibushi is at right guard, you've got three different starters.
Maybe in terms this is of about spots. Finding your guys, though.
Yeah, I mean, as we discussed at the beginning of the offseason, you know, continuity is important, but you have to make sure you have the right guys first and then have continuity. Now, signing Jokel and Ibushi to one-year contracts doesn't necessarily help with that continuity. Schneider had a comment, was asked about that, about the one-year contracts, by the way, and he mentioned compensatory.
He said they felt burned by that Jermaine Kearse contract from the last year.
He mentioned comp picks as a reason to do it. Like, if guys play well and in enhance their value, then they can benefit in terms of comp picks. Which,
interesting.
I mean, it makes sense, but still, I think it makes more sense with someone like Ibushi, where you clearly got a value with them, than with someone like Jokel.
You would sign him for, and I don't know if I agree with that.
But I don't know if Ibushi would have signed a two-year contract for that same amount.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying, is you saved money this year with him. With Jokel, it's unclear that you actually saved that much money. Let's see, they also talked about Dewey McDonald, who, Brett Dewey McDonald?
Bradley McDougald?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, it is. Who they see is in the competition at multiple safety, at both safety spots, and then is in
three or four safety spots,
and then is in nickel corner.
Yes.
So multiple positions. Not tremendously surprising, I don't think, from that standpoint. I think that's probably
I'm very in on that signing. I think it's great signing.
Yeah, I like him better in that role than like strictly as a free safety.
Oh, and a chance for him to get on the field.
Right. Assuming Earl Thomas stays healthy. Anything else stand out for me from their comments?
Not really. I mean, it was mostly about, I think, seeing Jermaine Effetti. I'm not going to say he was a great guard last year, but somebody who they did invest a high pick in, looking at moving him to the tackle position is interesting.
I mean, I feel like this was the long-term plan all along.
I don't see why you don't do it right away, but okay. I mean, it's not like they were so set at right tackle last year that they shouldn't do it.
I think it's partially feeling like it's easier to jump in the NFL pool at right guard and then adjust to right tackle as opposed to trying to do both of those at the same time, I guess.
Okay.
I don't know.
But I do like it. I like that. And I mean, I'm very in on Odeyabushi, and I like him. It's seeming like he's almost certainly going to get on the field. And when you look at that line, you just say, this is a maybe competent NFL line, and with everything else that's going on at every other position, have to feel pretty confident right now.
They were pretty positive about the running back rotation.
They were pretty positive about all things in the universe.
Obviously, but Thomas Rawls notably mentioned in there, so you know he still figures into that. What did you make of the comments about Richard Sherman? And basically both of them said, look, we'll explore anything, which I think the media again took is, oh, they're definitely interested in trading Richard Sherman.
I think it's probably nothing, but it was a strange way to respond to the question.
I mean, on the one hand, they could have shut down the conversation by just saying, no, we're not interested in trading Richard Sherman. But I think, first off, you open yourself up to, well, if a great offer comes along, then people say, well, you just said you weren't going to trade him. It's, you know, like the
everybody's, if the offer's right, you're always open to anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's my ultimate thing. Stan Van Gundy had a rant about this a few weeks ago that summed up my thing. Like, you know, he's like, okay, well, if the Warriors come offering Steph Curry and Kevin Durant for LeBron James, are the Cavaliers going to, like, not make that trade? I mean, maybe, but
I don't think they'd make that trade. I don't know. It's a tough call.
Steph Curry and Kevin Durant? I think you got to make that trade.
Okay, they'd probably make it, but LeBron James has a new trade clause.
Don't throw that in the trade machine. That's also true. But his point being...
Also, I think LeBron James might be the GM of the Cavs.
Everyone... Nah, that's overrated. Everyone in the league is available at the right price. It is. It's overrated. Everyone in the league is available at the right price. Now, yes. Like the what that price would be for Russell Wilson is like.
I want to hear more about this LeBron James being the GM being overrated.
I mean, if he was the GM, they would have made it traded for a backup point guard when he kept complaining about it, and they didn't.
Maybe he didn't find the right offer.
Sure. He complained about his own GM in the media. That's a weird move. I mean, I don't know what that offer would be for Russell Wilson, but, you know, theoretically, if it's like Dak Prescott and like 5 first-round picks, then, you know, we love you, Russ, but...
That's a good question. Is there anybody who you would trade Russell Wilson for?
That's maybe a summer podcast for us at some point.
I don't think. The answer is no. I definitely do not believe that Dak Prescott's that good of a quarterback, but okay.
Oh, but Dak Prescott at that salary and all the first-round picks, I would do it. Love you, Russ.
No way. Okay.
A couple other pieces of news this week.
I did not know that we'd be discussing Dak Prescott and 5 first-round picks for Russell Wilson.
I'm just saying. The NFL outlawed leaping and kick on to block kicks. And I got to tell you, I'm okay with it.
What?
I know that's actually what we're going to fight about. That's my hot take in Seahawks Twitter.
I feel like we've been talking for too long for me to really fight with you about this. But that is the worst take because you are witnessing what it was sports about. It's about seeing people at the highest peak of physical abilities. And I remember seeing Cam Chancellor for the very first time in the playoffs leaping over the line, and I said to myself, that was one of the greatest feats of human ability. And why would you want to take that away?
It is certainly one of the most memorable and exciting plays that didn't actually count, the pair of plays that didn't actually count in NFL history. But here's the thing is, you want to see that high-level athletic performance without the risk of injury.
What is the risk of injury? To like, whom?
Like, people jumping over people is inherently an unsafe thing. It's unsafe.
You have no evidence for this being unsafe. You're just making a statement.
Has
anybody ever been injured jumping over the line? No. Kickoffs are more unsafe than jumping over the line.
I mean, that's not untrue. The fact that the players...
We should outlaw kickoffs then, which I don't think there should be kickoffs.
Obviously, there should not be kickoffs. The Players Association advanced this rule. Like, everyone wants to put it on the evil, no-fun NFL. Like, add it again. The Players Association put
Hate
this
the
out
Seahawks.
There.
Seahawks.
Like, it's not just Bruce Arians, guys. The vote was unanimous. It was 32-0. Even the Seahawks voted to ban it.
Like, that kind of undercuts
your
Bobby
argument.
Bobby Wagner voted for it. It's crazy. The Seahawks voted for that?
The team. I mean, I'm saying, I don't know whether there was a vote among the Players Association reps. I'm saying
the
front office.
But the vote was unanimous?
Yeah, it was 32-0.
What in the hell?
I mean, ultimately, it's not a play that really matters that much.
So more people voted for that than voted for making $75 million or whatever from the Raiders moving to Las Vegas.
Yes.
Wow. I'm shocked by this.
So.
Wow.
The last news, a bit of disappointing news, certainly, that Trevon Boykin was arrested over the weekend for public intoxication and marijuana possession after a car that he was a passenger in reversed quickly through a crowd of people and hit some pedestrians on the sidewalk, and then before eventually running into a bar.
That's so great.
Yeah, I mean,
but also people need to realize you're not in Washington State always.
I mean, it's disappointing that marijuana possession is still a big deal here, but anywhere, but
there.
Yeah, not here, I guess is the accurate way to put it. But that those are the laws, so you sort of are obligated to follow them, especially in the case of Trevon Boykin, when you know you've had run-ins with the law in the past, and I think that. That complicates his future with the Seahawks.
Are you in on the idea of Colin Kaepernick being signed as the backup quarterback?
Oh, 100%.
God, I want him to be signed. Oh,
wouldn't be
so
in it.
Bad.
I don't think it makes sense for Colin Kaepernick. As much as everyone thinks he's being blackballed, I think at some point...
Listed.
I think either of those work.
Okay.
I think at some point a better offer than this will come along for him. It is still relatively early in the offseason. But... if no better offer comes along and he's willing to sign for, you know, not much more than the minimum to be the backup quarterback for the Seahawks, then of course, 100% I'm in on it. So in on it. What?
I'm looking at the word blackball. this seems. I guess it's right. I don't know. I mean, John Harbaugh disputed the. So people have used the exact term blackballed, but it doesn't seem right to me from the definition of it. Anyway, I want Colin Kaepernick as the backup so bad because the greatest fear that we have at any time is Russell Wilson being injured, right?
Yep.
And if we have Colin Kaepernick as the backup quarterback, that fear is not completely alleviated, but quite a bit. I mean, I think we all know how dangerous Colin Kaepernick can be and think he's a good quarterback. Yeah. At least a competent starting caliber NFL quarterback.
I mean, certainly Richard Sherman's support for him was interesting because if anyone has like done well against Colin Kaepernick, it's Richard Sherman, I would say.
Just likes Colin Kaepernick as a competitor.
But I like Pete Carroll saying that he was a starting caliber quarterback. I like that. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess you can't blame the Seahawks because they don't have a starting job to give.
No.
The teams that you should be blaming are like the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, the Jets. Definitely the Jets. It's 100% the Jets.
So, but I'm very into this idea. Like, if Colin Kaepernick is signed as the Seahawks backup quarterback, I am going to be thrilled.
Are you going to get a Colin Kaepernick jersey?
100%. I don't know. Probably wouldn't get the jersey of any backup quarterback.
But it seems like a poor investment. Since he would probably only be here 1 year. He would definitely be a one-year contract.
Well, and the other negative of it, we just don't want to... I don't think there would be a quarterback controversy.
You don't think there would be a quarterback controversy?
You are underestimating the ability of like sports radio's interest in making things controversies.
Like even Hugh Millen wouldn't think that Kaepernick should be the starter over Russell Wilson.
Hugh Millen would eat his shoe if Russell Wilson is the starting quarterback over Colin Kaepernick.
Was that what he said?
I think so. I think
okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that people would talk about it being a quote-unquote distraction in the locker room because of the fact that people would ask about Kaepernick kneeling for the anthem. But
well, he already even now said he won't kneel next year. It's done. You put it to rest.
Okay. Now his distraction is just donating to various civil rights issues.
Well, he didn't vote last year.
Yeah.
But I'm very in on Colin Kaepernick. All right. We agree. Both somehow love Colin Kaepernick. What is time? What happened?
I mean, look, Colin Kaepernick's pass sent the Seahawks to the Super Bowl for which they ultimately won. So let's be clear here. It would not have happened without Colin Kaepernick.
Always. Two people who have thrown passes in the last 10 years that have sent the Seahawks to the Super Bowl. Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson.
Yep. Indisputable facts. Indisputable facts.
Maybe Jake Delhomme before then.
I don't think there's any single pass that sent the Seahawks to the Super Bowl in 2006. It was a much less close game. All right. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.